This morning's reading presents stark contrasts. There is conduct motivated by fear, distrust. There is astounding faith and mercy. There is all too human self-serving behavior, and there is forgiveness rooted in a love that is greater than any human heart could muster. If anyone were likely candidates for counseling, I suppose Joseph and his brothers would fill the bill. Maybe a little bit of SBT, is that right? Solution-oriented brief therapy. Professor Salmon doesn't think I know about such things. I try not to. SBT, it's probably the way to go for all that has gone on. Don't rehash the past. Don't drag out the dirty laundry, including the coat of many colors, for too much water has gone over the dam and down the Nile for all that. Better to press ahead. Goodness knows they have a lot to set straight, this family. But given how things unfold, the brothers might not be ready after all. For Freud, for SBT, or whatever, they talk of reconciling, a common practice when a father would die, but they seem out really to save their skins. Bad move, but that goes hand in hand with bad judgment as they take stock of their famous sibling. They don't give Joseph much credit, do they, for anything but being human, rather like they are. This is the last episode of a long tale of stress and strain well beyond the common sibling rivalry. Such an interesting relationship that the German novelist Thomas Mann spent 3 volumes musing about it in his Joseph and Seine Brüder, Joseph and His Brothers, 1,200 plus pages, which tells you Mann took a lot of literary license with the text. That's almost as long as the Bible. But he has some things to say about culture and a lot to say about human nature. And yet, while it's very interesting, the Genesis text, of course, gets the authoritative nod, because we know from Mann that he deals on the level of human relations, which ought to drive us to take a little closer look at Genesis 50. As the curtain goes up, Jacob has died. The loss of the family patriarch prompts grief, but there is more. There is fear in the brothers' minds. As they see things, Jacob's death means their shield is now gone. And what next? This ought to be a time to heal, but there's no telling what Joseph will do. Expect the worst. He's sure to take revenge, especially for putting him in the well, selling him into slavery, and for letting their father believe a lie all those years about his death. In fact, it was worse than if he were dead, for they even got the price of a slave for him. Joseph said that was all behind, but did he mean it? Would he nurse a grudge? Would he harbor this and bide his time until he'd be free to unleash his fury? It is very sad that they think this way, but isn't it natural? The brothers should know. And so what do they do? They compound suspicion with more all-too-human behavior. They seek cover behind words attributed to Jacob, some last words. Attributed, I say, because there really is no proof Jacob said it. Genesis 49 recounts his blessings to all the sons and his final instructions, but there's no mention of this. Could well be a ruse. And it makes sense, given what we've seen from them. Terrified, the older brothers cook up a story. Some deathbed words, they invoke God as well along the way. And then just to buffer things a little bit more, they send someone else to spread the word, someone else who can't quite be caught up in the lie. Just what was that story again? We don't know who it was. Some commentators, along with Mann, think that Benjamin was the likely choice, given his special bond with Joseph. Regardless, the messenger tests the waters, and in your mind, can't you just see them? The brothers far enough away, yet hovering close to see what Joseph's reaction will be to the news. There's no Genesis warrant for that, not the details, but we can well imagine. They act, and here I think Mann has them nailed, they act like a bunch of toadies. Clever in how they've set things up. Human nature on display. And don't we understand? And Joseph's response, his eyes welled up with tears. True or not, the message was painful. If a lie, what does that say of what the brothers think of him, their lack of trust? If true, what does it say about what the fathers estimated of his son. In either case, Joseph is grieved, but he will have none of this. He will not rest at this place. Am I in the place of God? He asks. Quite a question. Is he? Well, of course not. Vengeance is God's alone. Joseph instead has lived by faith, by trust, depending on the faithfulness of God no matter what came. Revenge is not his to dish out. But ask it again. Is Joseph in the place of God? In another sense, yes. Yes, because he stands there to speak to those who come from the family, who come in repentance, to speak a word of love and forgiveness. It is hardly a stellar performance by the brothers. It takes a while before they throw themselves at his feet, at his mercy. It is the ultimate response by Joseph, not from human spirit alone, but more. Moved by the love of God, he knows that God has shown him this, and it is his to shower on others. The brothers feared Joseph's long memory. Joseph lived by God's even longer memory and by long arms that sustained him. You meant it for evil. God has meant it and turned it for good. T.S. Eliot, the poet, once wrote, "This is the use of memory for liberation, not less of love, but expanding of love beyond desire, and so liberation from the future as well as the past." Ralph Ellison, the African-American author who wrote The Invisible Man back in the early 50s, used Eliot's line to start an unfinished manuscript for another book called Juneteenth. There's a tragedy, unfinished. He had it done in the days before computers and multiple copies, and his wife came home from shopping to find the house ablaze and the one manuscript copy in the study. So he started over. Juneteenth is his book. Juneteenth is actually June 19, 1865. That's where the term comes from. It's a day when the federal troops went to Galveston and announced to the slaves there that actually they had been freed, declared freed, 2 years earlier by Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. And the residents called it Juneteenth, an ambiguous name for their ambiguous situation, for they thought they were one thing, other people said they were another. They didn't know quite what they were, but they now had to learn to live with their true status, not to be mired in bitterness, but to be freed for the future. Legally free, they had to come to grips with what had happened to them to gain liberation on another level, which is why Ellison invoked the Eliot poem, "Memory can be poison, memory can free." And he builds on that image in Juneteenth. His book, Ellison's, is set in the 1950s and 60s. In it, we see a race-baiting Southern senator nearly assassinated on the Senate floor, shocking everyone by calling but one visitor to his hospital bedside, Daddy Hickman, an old black Southern gospel preacher, the last person anyone would expect the senator to see. As it turns out, as we see both in their minds and see the conversation, by a twist of fate, the senator had once been orphaned and raised by Hickman long ago, but they went their different paths. They parted company and did much to deny the family link, the human connection. And now, sobered by a hail of bullets, they struggled with memory to get beyond their failings, to be prisoners neither of the past nor the future. They realized, and this is crucial, they themselves could not erase the past, but memory at least could free for what lies ahead. Ellison died before he got the book done a second time. His literary executor pared it down from 2,000 pages to what's in print, but it's still not quite finished. It breaks off a kind of lesson, I suppose, of Ellison beyond the grave that we have much to do in society today. But on another level, far longer than Juneteenth even, Joseph knows the lessons before Eliot or Ellison ever wrote a poem or a novel. For memory can enslave or it can free. Joseph knows. How shall he respond? Bitterness aside, he remembers how God stood by him. Memory liberates him, in turn to show love. And there, finally, is the lesson for us this day. We remember much how we have been toward each other, how we have been toward God, but thankfully we remember even more things valuable. How God has claimed us as his own, made us his in baptism, put Christ's name upon us, how he stands by us in love despite our wanderings, welcoming us back after we have been all too human, because he remembers his promises. Because he sacrificed his son, we live as free children, and we hold to the memory of his faithfulness, free to show love. Do we stand in the place of God? Not to remember to the third and fourth generations, but yes, to remember the loving kindness and to bring that memory before others, to bring that so that they may live, we all may live with one another, to live by his mercy through Christ, to speak of the same. Tomorrow we focus on church on the brink with changes all about, but here is something permanent, unchanging, a picture of the family of God to hold in remembrance again for a new day.